8. The White Rajas of Sarawak. She drives back into town at dawn, her sixth day in West Texas. The fatigue that weighs on her is like one she has never experienced before. No doubt, Haley surmises, the unplanned pregnancy has something to do with this unfamiliar lethargy. What compels her to push through this exhausted, sleep-deprived state is a sense she is getting closer to the truth, to answers, of making the history right. As always, the accoutrements of a normal life seem of secondary importance. Haley accepts this sacrifice. She must if she is to continue her work for the deeper state. Her relationship with Sam was a casualty of that dedication to the country and its constitution. The same must be true for an unwanted pregnancy. Pushing her conflicted emotions into the recesses of her active consciousness, Haley narrows her focus as if through a loopholed rifle scope. On target. She is an operative, not a mother. Haley reckons that later today will be the best time to take the pills, after she is confident that Culberson's cooperation has been secured. On a Saturday at daybreak, El Paso is a slumbering, low-lying rattletrap of tire joints, strip malls, transmission shops, and fast food franchises, hours from opening for the day's trade. The sky is a vast cyan blue scrim, nearly indistinguishable from the dark Franklin Mountains to the west. A relentless sun will soon breach the placid pre-dawn gloom, and August will again broil all in its grip. Until then, the city broods. Haley clocked the dude slinging dope from under the shuttered restaurant's red and white striped awning on Dyer Street while out for a pre-dawn run earlier during her stay. Sorrento Italian restaurant is permanently closed, another casualty of the pandemic and collapsed oil prices. The scrawny white kid wearing baggy cargo shorts, Nikes, and a Houston Astros jersey uses its doorway as a place of business. His New York Mets snapback hat suggests a casual degree of team loyalty. Confirming the drug dealer is at his usual spot, Haley drives past the location and turns right at Fred Wilson Avenue. Right again at Lackland, to an alley that takes her into the parking lot behind the restaurant. If she had the money, Haley would avoid the hassle of robbing the guy, but she doesn't have the extra cash. The Warhawk in her trunk will have to do. In a way, the deeper state operative reasons, she's doing the city of El Paso a favor. A little less dope on the street. Haley doesn't bother with the holster. Holding the .45 caliber handgun down at her right thigh, she walks quickly up the side of the squat adobe-style building to where the squirrely drug dealer waits for his next drive-up customer. He prefers selling to the working schmucks of the world who require a boost before putting in at the 9-to-5. These customers tend to be of a higher caliber human being than the dope fiends who venture out later in the day or at night. A lot less dangerous, too. "Hey," she says, raising the gun to chest level. The look on the guy's face confirms he didn't register her approach until Haley is essentially on him. Total compliance is his only option. He has never been robbed before. Not on the morning shift. Not by anyone but the cops. Words seize in his throat and come out as a garbled shout. Haley grips his shirt front and hauls him back into the recessed entryway. She wonders if the guy is cold, standing outside in his goofy cargo shorts. A weather front has moved into the region, dropping early morning temperatures into the 50s. On the horizon to the west, a wall of clouds looms ever closer. She says, "I want all of it."
"Fuck you!"
His exclamation has a plaintive tenor. Haley recognizes a young man who has been beaten down repeatedly in his short, brutal life. A human punching bag. Where she grew up, you were prey or a predator. If she hadn't escaped the world of her upbringing, the deeper state operative wonders what role she would have played. "All of it," she repeats.
"I don't even have the stuff on me, dumbass."
"It's not far away, though. And if you don't take me to it in the next 3 seconds, I'll blow your shit for brains out the backside of your head." The drug dealer blinks, calculating the odds she's bluffing. "One."
"Okay, okay."
"Let's go." Haley gestures with the gun. Cargo shorts sliding off his non-existent hips, the drug dealer leads the way from the restaurant's entrance and around the corner of the building.
Halfway down its length on the ground is a Taco Bell box. It's not the only piece of discarded garbage to catch Haley's eye. Assessing the amount of trash in the parking lot, she concludes that El Paso suffers from either a scarcity of public trash receptacles or a doesn't-give-a-shit populace. The drug dealer stops a few feet from the grease-spotted carton and points at it with the toe of his stained Nike.
There!
Pick it up and hand it over. He obeys. Haley accepts the box and, keeping the guy covered with her gun, cracks the lid open. She seems satisfied with what she sees inside.
Go on. Get the hell out of here.
The drug dealer pops the briefest of sneers, relieved she isn't robbing him of the $243 in his pockets. He hesitates before hauling ass out of there.
You don't strike me as the average jibhead.
Haley needs him gone before she can return to her car parked behind the building. She says,
Two.
Taking the hint, the drug dealer pivots and starts running, crossing the street and heading south on Dyer. The motel manager's Suzuki Forenza occupies its usual spot behind the office. Jerry Fishball has covered the skeleton shift for the last several days, his regular guy delayed while visiting family in Fort Worth. Something about a sick grandmother. Haley received this information from the motel manager 2 days ago when stopping by the office to pay for an additional week's stay. His chattiness was too obviously a ploy to keep her at the counter for longer than necessary. Fishball's gaze baldly rapacious. Haley tolerated the motel manager's leer only as long as she needed to gather intel. She devised an action plan then and there. Pulling into the property at the first driveway, Haley parks behind the office and exits her rental car. She opens the driver's side door of the Suzuki, using a Slim Jim she fashioned from the bracket of a hanging file folder. Popping the trunk lid with the release button on the driver's door, the deeper state operative stows the Taco Bell box inside and locks up the car again. The El Paso Police Department receives her anonymous tip before she pulls into the parking space in front of her motel room. Lena Campos, 30 minutes into her shift, pushes a cleaning trolley up the walkway. Haley gives her a friendly wave as she exits the rental car. Entering her motel room, Haley instinctively drops to a half-crouch upon seeing April Wu in the reclining chair between the bed and front window.
God damn it!
What? Asks April innocently. Haley knows better.
You've got to stop doing that. Seriously.
April, wearing the same cargo pants and black Army Knights hoodie as before, shrugs. Even in the bad light, her sickly pallor is pronounced.
Gotta admire the tradecraft, right?
She asks.
No one should take any pride in defeating the security measures in place at the Beverly Crest Motor Inn, April.
I do. Her cocky grin is proof.
You would.
Haley turns to pull open the blinds, flooding the room with the first unimpeded rays of the morning sun. The dinginess of the motel room is hardly alleviated.
What are you doing here?
She asks without warmth. April gestures toward Jerry Fishbaugh's heap across the parking lot.
A better question is to ask why you're breaking into cars.
Haley releases an exasperated sigh she wishes she could have back. Her friend's mocking grin is savage.
Save yourself the heartache, slugger. Assume I know and see everything.
A police cruiser stops behind the Suzuki, visible through the motel room's window. Two El Paso patrol officers exit the vehicle and give the motel manager's car a good walk around. Haley, distracted by April's intrusion, can't fully observe the conclusion of her mission to rid Lena Campos of her abuser.
Let's get back to what you're doing here. I'm not the only one who's concerned about you.
After a pause, April adds,
Looking like shit, by the way.
I look like shit? April says,
I've got the gold-plated excuse, chill. Never forget that.
Outside in the parking lot, the two cops leave the Suzuki and walk toward the office door, disappearing from view. The deeper state operative experiences another surge of weariness. She craves sleep. April is the only thing between Haley and a few hours of much-needed rest. Getting rid of her becomes an acute priority. I'm pregnant.
Simple and direct, like a 45 caliber round right between the eyes.
I know.
Haley's sleep-deprived state aggravates a pre-existing annoyance with her friend, but not by much.
Fuck!
Relax. The receipt for the misoprostol you left crumpled up in the trash can.
April gestures at the receptacle next to the bed.
Tell the world, why don't you?
Haley can only blame herself for this unintentional reveal. She retrieves the prescription bottle from her tote and stashes it unceremoniously in a toiletry travel bag in the bathroom. As if that would make the whole business disappear from her life.
What's the plan?
Asks April. A flustered Haley re-enters the room.
With the pregnancy? What do you think? People like us, we can't keep tropical fish.
You had a dog.
For 2 minutes. Sam took Yazet.
Sam.
The expression on April's face asks the obvious question.
No, I haven't told him, and I don't plan to.
Okay. April's head bobs with a judgmental cadence.
Look, I haven't slept in more than 24 hours. Today isn't going to be any less challenging.
You should probably go.
I just got here. What else am I going to do in fucking El Paso?
But bother me.
But bother you.
With morose resignation, Haley accepts that she has zero control over what her friend does or doesn't do. Waving her hands in front of her like she's walked into a swarm of houseflies, she says,
Really not in the mood, you know?
Copy that. April pauses ever so briefly, then says,
New topic. This business here. Who's blowing up the Permian Basin?
I'm working on it.
What can I do to help?
She gestures to herself, relaxing comfortably in Haley's motel room.
You've seen my work.
You know as well as I do that you can't do anything to help me.
Andrew Wilde?
Reluctantly cooperative.
Having a few ex-presidents backstopping you doesn't hurt.
Through the window, Haley sees the two El Paso patrol officers following Jerry Fishball back to his car. The motel manager seems agitated.
What's that all about?
Asks April, gesturing at the unfolding scene without actually looking in the cop's direction. Haley, however, watches the investigation with great intensity.
Helping a friend.
You don't have friends. April joins Haley at the window. They watch the motel manager at the cop's direction unlock the Suzuki. One of the patrol officers pops the trunk and searches it. Within seconds, she emerges from behind the raised trunk lid with the Taco Bell carton. Her partner cuffs an apoplectic Fishball, ignoring his histrionics.
Well, well, well. Another win for the good guys, says April.
Haley remains silent, watching the spectacle without expression. She feels more tired than ever. April has been staring at her for these last few seconds. She asks,
Should they be worried about you?
Who? Asks Haley.
Everybody.
With April's unwelcome intrusion, Haley relinquishes any hope for sleep. She steps out of the motel room, heading to her rental car parked directly in front of the door.
Hey!
Lena Campos stands in the open doorway of the room next to Haley's. The expression on her face is neither friendly nor hostile.
Hi,
is the best Haley can manage. Did the room cleaner see her plant the drugs in her boss's car?
He's gone. The police took him away.
Yes, I saw.
Haley pauses. Then,
he won't bother you anymore.
Lena has said all that she is going to say. Fixing her gaze on the deeper state operative for another few moments, she betrays no sign of appreciation or gratitude for Haley's intervention. The silence hangs between them, an awkward indictment of the white woman's privilege. A stray dog enters the motel's parking lot from the street, taking a shortcut to the alley that runs behind the north wing. From one of the rooms farther east, a loud argument erupts between a recently married couple. Haley nods by way of goodbye and turns for her car. The housekeeper disappears inside the recently vacated room. Fishball or no fishball, she has only 15 minutes to prepare it for the next guest. Sitting behind the wheel of the fifth-hand pickup truck stopped across Dyer from the motel, Oswald watches the young woman get in her rental car. He has no clue what she said to the motel housekeeper. Something about cleaning her room? He witnessed the robbery of the drug dealer and subsequent framing of the motel desk clerk. None of it makes much sense to Oswald. What exactly is Haley Chill's fucking game? His contacts have already provided him with her name and recent work history. Her position in Senator Powell's office might go some way to explaining her activities, but not quite. Raised in relative poverty in West Virginia, a veteran of the U.S. Army and a former low-level aide in the disgraced Monroe administration, Haley Chill's story is a collection of odd, mismatched parts. An enigma, she seems to have a knack for being in the wrong place at the wrong time. Oswald has a hunch she is something other than a scrubby Senate aide. What exactly, he has no idea. As his target pulls out of the parking lot and heads south on Dyer, he buries his face in his right shoulder and starts his car's engine only after she has turned right out of the lot entrance and cleared the immediate area. He hopes like hell she doesn't note his necessary U-turn in her rearview mirror. In fact, Haley clocked the old pickup as she climbed behind the wheel of her rental car. Even from that distance, she recognized the driver as the man in black from the National Guard camp in Balmoray. As she pulls out onto Dyer Street, Haley doesn't even bother checking her rearview mirror. She knows he will follow her once she is underway. Haley is surprised by the sloppiness of her adversary's tradecraft. Did he think the old Ford made him less conspicuous? That he isn't trained, at least with a basic understanding of espionage, is a given. But that incompetence doesn't necessarily lessen the threat he poses. Surveillance requires finesse and skill, but any asshole can pull the trigger of a gun. Haley mulls the possibility of dropping her pursuer, doubling back and putting a tail on him. But the greater priority is nailing down Culberson's cooperation. Drive time to Fort Bliss is 12 minutes. She doesn't again consider the ramifications of the man tailing her, even though he follows her the entire way to the gate at Chaffee Road. Too much else on her mind. Always too much. Pogue called earlier with confirmation that Criminal Investigation Command was holding the National Guard major at the 93rd Military Police Headquarters. Having passed through the Chaffee Gate with the credentials provided to her by the CID agent, Haley proceeds to the location on Cassidy Road. The army post hums with activity, awash in pale August sunlight. A respite from the summer's heat can't last long, and people seem to relish the relatively cool temperatures, pausing to chat on the sidewalk or sitting on benches outside. Haley clocks the increased activity on base and makes a mental note to ask her CID contact about it. Parking in front of the MP headquarters, she sees Pogue exiting his car. They meet on the walkway leading to the building entrance. Chief?
Ms. Chill, you look like shit, if you don't mind me saying.
I don't mind. It seems to be a popular opinion.
Working on a weekend, we'll do that to you. Why not get some rest? Culberson isn't going anywhere soon. Jurisdictional issues still need to be resolved.
I spoke with Washington earlier this morning, Mr. Pogue. The senator has taken a personal interest in the matter.
Fantastic, the chief warrant officer says dryly.
Haley gestures toward the building. Let's get inside, sir. Talk to the man. The deeper state operative hadn't talked with the senator from Kentucky, of course. She made her first and only call of the morning to Andrew Wilde. Her direct superior with Publius made the subsequent requests of sympathetic contacts at the Pentagon and within the Judge Advocate General's Corps. Haley was inclined to marvel at the reach and persuasive powers of the deeper state. Culberson's proposed clemency could not have come without a price. Judging by Wilde's demeanor, Culberson's cooperation better be worth the horse trading it required. In their encrypted email exchange following the call to her request, she assured her superior the stakes were exceedingly high. They're met just inside the doors by Command Sergeant Major Joseph Johnson, with Chief Warrant Officer Pogue in civilian clothes, as is customary for CID military investigators. Johnson does not offer a salute.
Chief!
Johnson's back is pool cue straight, his combat uniform pressed and starched. One glance at him and his surroundings confirms that he runs a tight outfit as the principal aide to the battalion commander. The building's entry lobby is orderly and gleamingly clean.
Enlisted men at their desks worked diligently regardless of the disruption.
Sergeant Johnson, this is Haley Chill from Senator Powell's office in Washington. She's here to speak with the detainee. He's in one of our holding rooms. Follow me, please.
His father, Travis County Judge Roy Culberson, was a lifelong Democrat with an innate compassion for the underdog that he shared with Nat's mother, Betty. Within the liberal-leaning and culturally sophisticated Culberson clan, Nathaniel was something of an outlier. Embracing a more rough-hewn, conventionally Texan, i.e. hell-raising, attitude, the oldest of four Culberson children relied on his father's prominent status within Austin's law enforcement circles to skate over legal troubles. Drunk driving arrests, bar brawls, an arrest for joyriding. The judge pulled the necessary strings to extricate Nathaniel from jam after jam that he prayed would be the last. Rock bottom took the form of expulsion from the University of Texas for theft of another student's property. The judge refused to make the problem go away. Disowned, the lifelong hellion found God and went in search of a new patron. A woman he met at church was the daughter of the largest car dealer in the state, precisely the kind of father-in-law that Nathaniel Culberson needed. With marriage and the arrival of a couple kids, the rehabilitated carouser rose through the dealership's ranks. At the encouragement of his father-in-law, a shameless racist, he joined the Texas Army National Guard, first as an enlisted citizen soldier and then as a commissioned officer at the age of 35. Culberson was not well-liked or much admired by those in his command. Deployed to Iraq and assigned to the quartermaster branch, he strove to line his own pockets. That baldly larcenous activity resulted in a breakdown in the supply chain and a dire scarcity of ammunition at some forward operations bases deep in country. Three soldiers died as a direct result of these shortages. A skillful bureaucratic manipulator, Major Culberson, implicated junior officers in the brigade, who unwittingly took the fall for him to cover up his crimes. The bare-knuckle bouts he has staged for the past 18 months are yet another illicit money-making scheme— gambling opportunities that afforded Culberson a healthy cut of the action. That these gladiatorial contests exploit pre-existing racial animosities are exactly the point. Pre-existing ethnic tensions are the juice. Never an ideologue, believing in nothing besides the accumulation of money, Culberson paid only lip service to his father-in-law's white nationalist beliefs. If there are financial opportunities in advancing white supremacy, then the liberal judge's son is all for it. Submerging himself in his wife's extended family, Nathaniel Culberson rarely spoke to his parents or siblings following the wedding ceremony. He has gone his own way, found a separate path. And that journey has taken him here, to a holding cell at the MP headquarters at Fort Bliss. The sergeant leads Haley and Pogue down a corridor of gleaming linoleum. Holding cells line the hallway to the left. Haley observes the detainees' faces framed by the narrow windows in the steel doors as she passes, and ponders on what infractions landed the prisoners in this unenviable place. Their gazes are accusatory, as if the deeper state operative were responsible for their misfortune. Loss of rank, dishonorable discharge, or worse, long-term incarceration at U.S. disciplinary barracks at Fort Leavenworth are just a few of the consequences these detainees can expect as they move through the Army's legal system like so many sausages in a meat processing plant.
Poor bastards, says Pogue as they walk past those distraught gazes. Only getting what they deserve, Chief.
Command Sergeant Major Johnson stops at the last door, key in hand. He glances through the window to determine Culberson's position on the other side of the door.
Oh, fuck!
The military policeman fumbles with his keys to unlock the door, dropping them in his haste. Pogue and Haley peer through the door window to see inside the holding cell as he bends down to pick them up. They see Culberson lying on the narrow cot, wrists slit. Blood floods across the green tile floor like a toilet's overflow.
Open the door, Sergeant! The CID agent bellows.
Johnson inserts the key in the lock. Haley follows the two men into the holding cell. The only object inside the 8x10 room is a cot. Any bathroom needs are handled by taking prisoners out in handcuffs to restrooms at the other end of the corridor. Haley stands aside while the others ascertain Culberson's condition. A spectator. Nothing she can do to help the man.
The military policeman barks into his radio, requesting EMT response while Pogue checks Culberson for a pulse. Haley watches as the CID agent lifts Culberson's arms in a vain attempt to slow the blood loss. She doesn't have to take the major's heart rate to know he's dead. And not by his own hand, despite the safety razor on the floor almost submerged by the blood. Culberson represented her best shot thus far at explaining the mystery surrounding her father's inexplicable fate. He had known Tommy Chill, or at least of him. Those truths died with the major. Kneeling at the prisoner's side, Pogue looks back over his shoulder at Haley. His expression telegraphs what she already assumed. The major is a goner. Blood smeared on the walls next to the cot suggests an unquiet death. She imagines Culberson's terror, held down by conspirators while an assassin carved each wrist open. In their efforts to resuscitate the major, Pogue and the military policeman fail to see what Haley only now notices herself. A few words scratched into the paint where baseboard meets the wall, across the room from the cot.
Why wasn't the prisoner issued a tire during processing? I don't understand. Chief, the major was brought into the facility at an hour when we have a quarter of our regular personnel on staff. Culberson would have received standard-issue detainee uniform this morning.
It's almost 1,100 hours,
bellows the criminal investigations agent. Haley watches from the doorway of the CSM's office as Pogue grinds a baleful Johnson. Lieutenant Colonel Oscar Wainwright, commander of the 93rd Military Police Battalion, leans with his back against the wall. He knows his turn is next. Culberson's death while in the battalion's custody is an insoluble black mark. Wainwright is experiencing the dread that comes with the realization that years of hard work building a military career have imploded.
Is she necessary to the discussion? He says to Pogue, referring to Haley.
Yes, sir.
The intensity of Roy Pogue's fury is notable, given that Wainwright outranks him. But Criminal Investigation Command enjoys unique privileges within the Army's vast bureaucracy. The 93rd Military Police Battalion might be in the same business, but there is no question which command carries more weight. The power dynamic in the room would be apparent to a child. Chief Warrant Officer Pogue is in charge here.
You really think a major in the Texas Army National Guard took the trouble to hide a blade in his clothing in case of arrest?
An incredulous Pogue asks the battalion commander.
If that's what my people believe, then yes. How else did it get there?
The CID agent employs his silence with devastating effect. Wainwright thrusts his index finger at Pogue like a bayonet.
Cut the BS, Pogue! I've got control of this command!
Haley Chill observes the exchange with a detached air. Culberson is dead. But in the final act of a man who realized his end was near, the major left a valuable clue, one that only she noticed. While Pogue and Johnson were futilely rendering aid to Culberson, Haley crouched down to read the words the detainee had crudely scratched into the baseboard, the tiny incisions obviously freshly made. Cecil X. Drummond III. She wants to follow up on the lead and is keen to extricate herself from the blame game at the MP headquarters. Haley anticipates increased resistance from her CID contact. Pogue's attitude toward her has become one of intensifying aggravation. The deeper state operative can hardly fault him. Since arriving in West Texas, she has left a trail of dead bodies in her wake. That incidental mayhem would go a long way toward explaining his increasingly cantankerous behavior around her. Or he simply dislikes her. Either way, Haley needs to get going. Clearing her throat to draw the attention of the three men in the cramped office, Haley says, "Videotape doesn't lie. Not typically, at least." Command Sergeant Major Johnson frowns for dramatic effect.
"Unfortunately, our surveillance cams on this floor went down late yesterday. Still waiting for tech."
Johnson's commander mutters an obscenity. Pogue shakes his head in disgust, seemingly unsurprised. He exchanges a pissed-off look with Haley despite his growing animosity toward her. Looking for sympathy? She has no time for it. Haley gestures with a tilt of her head, letting the CID agent know she is intent on leaving. Pogue looks to Wainwright.
Give me a second, Colonel.
He follows Haley into the corridor. I'm sorry, Chief. The Senator is after me for a report of everything that's occurred in the last 24 hours.
Fine. We'll get back to you later.
Of course, sir. The CID agent shakes his head, glancing back toward the doorway to Johnson's office.
This shit ain't straight.
No, sir.
And so what are you going to say to your boss, Ms. Chill?
The truth, Mr. Pogue. He grimaces. Somehow, the warrant officer knew she was going to say that. The scheduled flight time between Dallas and El Paso is 1 hour and 34 minutes. Haley hopes to close her eyes for some of that time. Though the pandemic is long over, air travel has yet to return to normalcy. Consequently, the plane is barely half full and the two seats next to her unoccupied. The prospects for sleep are good were it not for her growing excitement. Haley feels she is close. If not to a resolution, then to a better idea of what exactly is happening here in Texas. And her father's role in the plot. The higher up the chain of command she climbs, the more determined to hunt down the truth she becomes. This is big. Haley is almost afraid to close her eyes. Will she dream again of her father hanging by the neck in the doorway of his disheveled bedroom? These recurrent nightmares have been a torment since that awful Sunday morning. But without sleep, her operational abilities degrade by the hour. As the airliner tilts up into its ascent over the cluttered expanse that is the city of El Paso, Haley forces her eyes closed. Let the visions come. Bring it. When Haley Chill drives off base, Peter Oswald is 50 miles east on the interstate. Duties elsewhere demand his attention. The organization has more than enough sympathizers to handle any job, activated with a single phone call. Before he hit the road, in response to James Woodside's last-minute request for a meeting of the conspiracy's captains, Oswald dialed a certain phone number. Within 10 minutes, storm operatives were posted outside every gate leading out of Fort Bliss, watching for their target's rental car and ready to follow. Oswald suspects Haley Chill made him while leaving the Beverly Crest Motor Inn or on the drive to the base. Fresh eyes on her is a good thing. As he drives, the thump of truck tires passing over drainage seams in the roadway keeping a steady beat, Oswald reflects on the loss of Nathaniel Culberson. The major's role in the organization was a vital one. Given the fact that the conspiracy is on the verge of reaching its critical phase, a replacement immediately assumed Culberson's responsibilities. Oswald can only hope that the new man, and he must acknowledge that most, if not all, of the Storm's senior leadership are male, possesses fewer of the personal flaws that led to the major's downfall. The stakes are too high for any more near exposures. Culberson has been handled, but Haley Chill remains an unknown and potentially catastrophic threat. Oswald must decide quickly how best to proceed. Reflecting on his first sight of the young woman at the New Mexico compound, he comprehends how far she has come in her ad hoc investigation. The Senate aide from Washington, if that is indeed her real job, is drawing far too close to the organization's highest ranks. A few minutes earlier, his cell phone rang with news that Haley Chill has boarded a flight for Dallas. Pete Oswald instantly understood why she was going to that destination. He knows what must be done. Ironically, an army base has more restrictive regulations regarding personal weapons than the civilian world. Consequently, Haley left the Warhawk hidden in her room at the Beverly Crest Motor Inn when she visited Fort Bliss that morning. Not having the time to swing by the motel before catching her flight meant leaving the gun behind. Given the events of the past few days, but most acutely Culberson's probable murder, the deeper state operative feels vulnerable and exposed without a weapon as her plane lands in Dallas. Mindful of possible surveillance, Haley takes the rental car shuttle bus to the DFW Rental Car Center, where she merges with a throng of departing passengers, climbing aboard a shuttle back to the airport Terminal A. Once there, she catches a Dallas-area rapid transit train into the city. Renting a vehicle downtown takes only a few minutes. Within an hour of landing, Haley is behind the wheel of a Hyundai Accent and navigating to the Cedar Grove Country Club north of the city. After walking out of the military police headquarters at Fort Bliss, she called Andrew Wilde from her parked car with Cecil Drummond's name.
5 minutes later, her deeper state superior called back with the thumbnail biography. Previous to his current position as a wealth manager, Drummond was a North Carolina-based financial con artist who ran a boiler room operation that directed minority borrowers toward unnecessary and punitive subprime loans. The 2008 real estate crash and subsequent FBI investigations brought an end to that rapacious illegal operation. Following that debacle, Drummond moved to Texas, and in the ensuing 13 years amassed a sizable number of affluent clients whose assets he manages for substantial fees. Cedar Grove is one of the city's most exclusive country clubs, founded exactly 50 years ago and constructed on 200 acres of cotton fields and pasture. In the 1800s, the Shawnee Trail traversed these same lands, the principal route by which Texan longhorn cattle were delivered to railheads north of the Red River. Today, golfers wearing pastel-colored short pants walk these same grounds. Haley is stopped at the gate and tells the guard she is an employee of Cecil Drummond's, carrying materials he needs for a presentation that has already commenced. She implies a sense of urgency, and the guard, swayed in no small part by her powder blue eyes, instructs Haley to leave her car near the front entrance of the main building. Having parked the rental Hyundai in an exclusive hub of gleaming Bentleys, Mercedes, and Jaguars, Haley heads inside the casually opulent club and is mostly ignored. Dressed as she is and younger than most members, she looks like staff. Her demeanor, however, suggests something other than servile obedience. A hardness has come to her gaze, sullen determination in the firmness of her jaw. Despite Haley's best efforts on the short flight, she hasn't slept in 30 hours. With a sense that events are coming to a head, the deeper state operative has lost all patience. A sign in the lobby, "Financial Opportunities in Year Zero," indicates that the seminar is located in the Honey Springs meeting room. Haley heads in that direction. Walking down a long, carpeted hallway past the club's main dining room, she clocks two security men, wearing dark blazers and pants, keeping guard of the doors leading into the conference room. She stops, pondering her next move, and sees unmarked service doors on the same side of the hallway as the meeting venue. Fatigue grinding her down and battling a persistent mental fog, Haley enters the club's service corridor and discovers it connects the kitchen with the main dining room, as well as every meeting room in the wing. Finding the rear service entrance into the Honey Springs room, she pulls the door open and slips inside. White tablecloths drape the 22 round dining tables spaced throughout the expansive room. Club staff has already cleared lunch service. The 180 guests in attendance, all white and over the age of 50, enjoy coffee and iced tea as they listen with rapt attention to the luncheon speakers standing at the front of the semi-darkened room. Cecil X. Drummond III. With an athletic physique secured by his regular triathlon training and generously highlighted by a handsomely tailored suit, the wealth manager makes his pitch to the well-heeled crowd. A sprawling 30-foot LED wall and high-volume, low-profile array speakers behind him lend a corporate gloss to the presentation. Hanging back to one side of the meeting room and ignored by all in attendance, Haley Chill studies a map of North America currently depicted on the video wall. The borders as drawn are like none that she has seen before. The states of Texas, New Mexico, and much of Arizona, Oklahoma, and Kansas comprise one national identity separate from the remainder of the substantially diminished United States. Divided into five new states, each retaining their original names, the name of this new nation is Free States of America. The deeper state operative retrieves her cell phone and discreetly begins recording.
Together, strong. Together, united. Together, philosophically pure. The Free States of America will be a nation of commonality, a nation created so that all of its citizens are joined together in one purpose, one party, one belief under one God.
As Drummond speaks, the LED wall displays new images replacing the map. The scenes depicted are uniformly prosperous, revealing a world of happy privilege. The actors and models from the blatantly staged shots are unvaryingly white. Smiles abound.
We are not alone. The philosophies we embrace are shared by the citizens of other countries around the world.
Our leaders have already been in discussion and formed robust alliances with the Russian government, as well as powerful political parties in Germany, Australia, France, Italy, Turkey, and Greece. A coalition of like-minded international powers will arise in the course of only a few years, separate but equal. We will be joined together in our shared beliefs, a new kind of union of nations and nationalist parties. We are strong, ladies and gentlemen, and getting stronger. Our self-determination will be ironclad. That is my guarantee to you today. The free states of America will be a shining example on this continent, the envy of the entire world once again.
Drummond has learned to pause for the applause he receives with this line from his speech. He has delivered these words in dozens of banquet halls, living rooms, and financial workshops these past few months. He knows when he has an audience on the hook, as he does today.
Prosperity doesn't come cheap, friends. It takes money to make money, am I right? And it takes a whole lot of money to make a whole new country. The FSA requires the cooperation and direct participation of several thousand individuals just like you good people. New FSA citizens who will cement the nation's success through their investment in it. Ladies and gentlemen, the future is bright. Our cause has adherents throughout the U.S. military branches, ready and willing to do what's necessary to advance our patriotic vision. But these brave men and women cannot do their jobs without your generous support. And don't for a minute think that your contributions are a charitable gift. No, my friends. This is an opportunity to get in on the ground floor of a new country. An investment at year zero. Imagine those families of the 18th century who foresaw the business opportunities available in an emergent United States and acted. Your investment today in the FSA, ladies and gentlemen, is your toehold in a future of unlimited potential.
The crowd hoots and applauds as the video wall displays a diagram that suggests a nationalized oil and natural gas industry. Figures presented are in the billions of dollars.
Drummond must shout over the audience's hand clapping and joyful roar. Like the White Rajas of Sarawak, you and your descendants will be the benevolent rulers of this wondrous new realm!
Ovation washes over the beaming wealth manager.
Join us! He shouts over the clamor.
The lights come up. The attendees, buzzing with excitement, stand or otherwise prepare to leave. Drummond remains at the front of the room.
Feel free to come on up, friends. I'm here to answer any of your questions. Grab the information packet on the way out, but please, I can't emphasize this point too strongly. Keep those materials and our discussion private.
He pauses again with polished comedic timing.
Rival producers would love to steal our movie idea.
Appreciative laughter greets the wealth manager's tongue-in-cheek stab at deniability. A cluster of older men and women line up for a word with the luncheon speaker. The spot to the side of the room where Haley had been watching the proceedings is now empty. Cecil Drummond finishes packing up his materials and gear. The meeting room is otherwise empty. The voice from behind startles him.
You're selling treason.
Haley has emerged from the rear service door and approaches to within only a few feet of where the wealth manager loads the last items into his briefcase. Whether it's the snake oil smile or Bruno Magli loafers, his physical proximity alone is enough to stoke her growing fury. But what the man sells with his slick presentation is the most vexing. Haley Chill has forfeited everything she has in the world to preserve and protect the United States of America and its Constitution. Untold thousands of brave men and women have fought and died in wars defending that sacred document. Drummond traffics in the crass betrayal of those grave sacrifices and takes a percentage on every share he sells. She has never despised anyone more in her life.
Excuse me?
Who's in charge? I want the names. All of them.
The words themselves are sharp-edged.
Look, young lady,
she snaps, though Drummond's more than 6 inches taller than the deeper state operative is physically fit, and outweighs her by a good 70 pounds, Haley moves on him with shocking speed. The wealth manager reacts by throwing a weak right hand. Haley deflects the punch with both hands, sweeping his arm down.
She buries a jab in his abdomen and then pushes the wealth manager over her extended right leg, putting him on the ground. Standing over Drummond and gripping his thumb with her left hand, Haley retrieves an ST DuPont fountain pen from his inside jacket pocket, flips the cap off her thumb, and presses the 14-carat solid gold nib into his ear.
Stop! Why are you doing this? I'm a wealth manager!
Haley releases her grip on Drummond's thumb and retrieves her phone from her tote on the floor where she dropped it, pressing play on the video she recorded of Drummond's sales pitch.
But please, and I can't emphasize this point too strongly, keep those materials and our discussion private.
Haley stops playback and leans into him.
Your secret isn't good with me, she asks. Who hired you? Fuck you!
Drummond struggles to escape. Haley responds by pushing the pen deeper into his ear. The wealth manager ceases, trying to escape.
Okay.
Who hired you? Who's in charge? Tell me the plan.
I don't know anything.
She presses the nib deeper into Drummond's ear, piercing his eardrum and pushing into the tympanic cavity. He yells in pain.
Stop!
But she's overwaiting. Done bargaining. No clemency, no mercy. Not anymore.
I'll stop when you talk. Tell me what I want to know.
Drummond resists the urge to talk. More dominant than the pain Haley inflicts on him are his fears. The wealth manager is aware of the consequences if he betrays the cause. Like Pete Oswald, he has witnessed the cruelty of their leader. The wealth manager begins to sob, helpless. His predicament is inescapable.
Someone calls and tells me where to go. I don't know who it is.
His fear and panic cause him to lose control of his bowels. He blubbers like a helpless baby. Utterly in her control.
I'm just a salesman, for Christ's sake.
Haley twists the expensive fountain pen inside his ear, the nib ravaging the Malleus, Incus, and Stapes. All destroyed. Blood flows freely now as the man shrieks in pain.
Killebrew!
What?
Killebrew! 2-star at Fort Bliss. Killebrew is in charge. He runs the whole operation.
Haley nods, withdrawing the pen from Drummond's ear. She looks up for the first time since initiating her interrogation, and only then sees the busboy standing in the doorway leading to the service corridor. The look of repulsed horror on the busboy's face clues Haley to the depths of her descent.
What have I done?
The busboy turns and flees the scene through the service door. Haley can hear his shouts of alarm from where she crouches over Drummond. She knows club security will be swarming the room and corridor outside soon enough, with local law enforcement arriving not long after. The deeper state operative stands and grabs a slightly soiled white cloth napkin from the nearest table and tosses it at the wealth manager. Press it against your ear. You're fine. Not all that fine, she muses. But people who are hopelessly fucked still seem to like hearing such bromides. Drummond sits up, palming the napkin to his ruined ear.
You fucking bitch!
Don't push your luck. I've got enough time before the cavalry arrives to make it a matching pair. The wealth manager suddenly realizes he has more to worry about than the loss of hearing in one ear. This most unfortunate incident will bring an excessive amount of attention to a movement that is unlikely to be confused for the concept of a Hollywood movie. This being Texas, he's carrying just the tool he needs to extricate himself from a bad situation. Drummond hikes up his left pant leg, revealing a Smith & Wesson M&P Shield subcompact 9mm pistol in an ankle holster. He draws the gun and points it at Haley.
By God, I ought to shoot your ass.
Haley is confident he won't. The wealth manager probably has a small arsenal at home, in his car and office, but she apprises him as a range shooter. Plenty of men will plug a woman at close range. Drummond isn't one of them in her estimation. As he struggles to get to his feet, keeping pressure on his injured ear with his left and gripping the gun in his right, Haley makes her move. Unspectacularly armed with her cell phone in one hand and expensive fountain pen in the other, she drops a shoulder to knock him flat. Drummond fires. So much for her snap judgment of his character. Luckily, the wealth manager's marksmanship, even at this close range, is errant. The shot is an inch wide of his target. Haley turns and runs for the service entrance at the back of the room as Drummond fires repeatedly, narrowly missing with each shot. Haley bangs through the service door and takes cover in the hallway as a final round follows her out, burrowing into the opposite wall. Followed by silence. Has Drummond left the scene? She sees security personnel coming her way at a dead run from the other end of the corridor near the main dining room. The wealth manager remains a prize, his knowledge of the plot obviously high level. Ignoring the security guard's shouted orders to stay where she is, Haley tosses the fountain pen and charges toward the service door again. Barging back into the meeting, she confirms her suspicion. The meeting room is empty. Turning to retrieve her tote, Haley sees that it's gone. Cecil Drummond speed walks up the corridor heading toward the club entrance. He feels the startled gazes of the members he passes. No doubt he must look a sight, disheveled as he is and pressing the blood-soaked napkin to the side of his head. The gun in his right hand only adds to what must be an outrageous display of plans gone horribly wrong. So what? One thought dominates. Get the fuck out of here while he still can. He has the woman's bag looped around his shoulder. Drummond took the tote as a precaution in case she had a weapon inside, as well as for possible clues to her identity. Those above him in the organization will want an explanation for the afternoon's mayhem. Drummond hopes giving them the bag will go some ways to assuaging their displeasure with him. Looking over his shoulder, he sees the blonde woman emerge from the meeting room back down the carpeted hallway. He pauses to raise the S&W subcompact and point it in her direction, but she keeps coming on at a run. Of course she would know he has emptied the magazine. Fucking bitch! The wealth manager barrels through the club entrance's open doorway, laying eyes on the valet. The valet? Waiting for his car to be retrieved is out of the question. The thought makes him laugh as he skids to a stop outside the entrance and short of the valet stand. Then, with the sort of fast-footed ingenuity that has been the hallmark of his prolonged, prosperous survival in the cutthroat world of asset management, Drummond remembers the woman's tote under his arm. With precious seconds ticking past, he searches the bag's interior and comes across the plastic car rental tag and Hyundai key fob. Looking up, the wealth manager sees the incongruent accent sandwiched between an Aston Martin and gleaming Range Rover. The Hyundai has got to be hers! Drummond dumps his gun in the tote and key fob in hand, runs up the circular drive to the VIP parking area. Haley exits the club seconds later and, clocking him, continues her pursuit. As she runs, the deeper state operative sees him approaching her rental car, unlocking its doors with the fob and climbing in behind the wheel. She is less than 50 yards away then as Drummond fires up the car's ignition, and the vehicle explodes in an expanding ball of flame outpacing the spray of ripped-apart automobile and human flesh by microseconds.